You're listening to the Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends.
I can't stop this feeling deep inside of me. Girl, you just don't realize what you do to me. When you hold me in your arms so tight, you let me know everything's alright. What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me. Lips as sweet as candy, its taste is on my mind. Girl, you got me thirsty for another. If I can for sure, all the good love when we're all alone, keep it up, girl. Yeah, you turn me on. I'm hooked on a feeling. I'm high on believing that you're in love. All the good love when we're all alone, keep it up, girl. Yeah, you turn me on. I'm hooked on a feeling. I'm high on believing that you're in love with me. I'm hooked on a feeling. You're in love with me. I said I'm hooked on a feeling.
Hello and welcome to the Stone Tapes. I'm Sam Stone, and in the studio with me today is the lovely Patricia H. Ash.
Hello.
David J. Howe.
I am David.
George Mann.
Hello.
And our special guest, a gentleman who is from the grassroots of Doctor Who fandom, and we'll be talking to him a little bit more, but this is Andrew Beach.
Good evening.
And I'm sure you can tell from the theme of the music what we'll be talking about today.
Secret, later.
So,
shh, shh. Don't
I'm not going to, no spoilers.
Keep it back.
No spoilers. But that was Hooked on a Feeling by Blue Suede. And our first things first, we're going to go over to Patricia's Corner.
Hiya. So, am I not in the microphone properly? Okay, I am now. Right, good to know. I have absolutely no idea how sound works, but
it's magic.
Just noise, you open your mouth,
it is magical. Absolutely magical. So this
day, evening,
this time,
wherever you are,
this time I'm going to talk to you about a book called Too Many Curses. In the it's in the sort of high comedic tradition of silly fantasy. If you liked Terry Pratchett's Discworld series or Douglas Adams' anything, you're really going to like this one.
Oh, great.
Yeah. It's absolutely hilarious. I've never read a book where the main character is a kobold, but she's a kobold.
Kobold.
Oh, she's it's a little gremlin-like thing. Generally, in mythology, it's like a gnome, but In this, it's like this furry dog-like minion.
I thought you said it was bald.
No, it's a kobold.
I thought it was like a piebald, so it's like black and white, only sort of kobold.
You know, it doesn't actually say. She might be like a black and white spotty dog thing, because it mentions her being dog-like and mentions her being hairy. So
okay.
She's
but it's a
fluffy
unique thing.
And She's super practical. What she is she's employed by a wizard named Margul the Horrendous as sort of his housekeeper slash minion. He really should have more minions, but he doesn't. He just has Nessie, who is the kobold. And so Margul the Horrendous really likes to curse people. That is kind of his, you know, every wizard has a thing. That's his thing. So his castle is full of people who he's put curses on. Like, there's one that he's cursed to be a sunflower. Somebody's a gargoyle. Somebody's a bat. There's a prince who is a frog. You know, classic curses and really inventive curses. All kinds of curses. There may, in fact, be too many curses.
Sounds like a lot to like, though.
Yeah. Yep. And then Margul the Horrendous brings home a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater. I'm not even kidding. Not even kidding. That's in the first chapter. And so through sort of a comedy of errors, the one-eyed, one-horned, flying...
This is easy for you to say.
The monster eats Margul. So then Nessie's like, well, this is... My boss has just been eaten by this thing that now thinks I'm its mother. Okay. So hilarity ensues, and, you know, with the death of a wizard, his spells don't tend to last particularly well, mm-hmm. so things start going wrong, and things start going weird, and strange things appear in the castle, and the castle seems like it's got its, like, this mind of its own. So Nessie, being the extremely practical kobold that she is, has to deal with that, and that is the book. I'm not going to spoil any more of it for you. It's hilarious.
It does sound like tremendous fun, doesn't it?
It is tremargulous.
Or muggulous.
Yeah, definitely 10 out of 10. Oh, that was...
And joining us by the wonders of internet, we hope, is Robin Pearce. Hello, Robin. How's the view from your castle this week?
I am Groot.
Not to be done.
That's all we're getting out of him now. Go on, Sam. Try and get the review now.
The whole review. I am Groot.
So, Robin, tell us then.
I'm talking to you by satellite link from Wales. This is amazing. This is even more astounding than it being sunny in Wales and raining where you guys are.
Yes, that's so unfair. It's so unfair. So, I guess then we know what you're going to be reviewing today.
Well, I've seen what's, I guess, the first of the big summer blockbusters in Guardians of the Galaxy Part 2. I went to see the first one when it first came out, obviously. And it was that very comic book movie, a comic book movie. Strangely enough, given the disproportionate amount of my life that I spent reading comic books, I still haven't read any. As the film starts, the Guardians are ready to do battle. And as usual, they can't really agree on anything, not even their strategy for taking on a monster.
Sorry, we're just going to have to halt you there, Robin, and we'll have to call you back on the landline because we're having little bit of problems.
Yeah, Groot has interfered, so yes. We have some music. Can't stay at home.
And that was The Runaways with Cherry Bomb. And we're back to Robin, hopefully with a better connection this time. Robin, to tell us again, Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Was
yeah,
it
I'm
worth
still
it?
Groot.
You're still Groot.
I'm still Groot.
Right. It's odd, but having enjoyed the first Guardians movie as much as I did, and I said at the time that it was the most fun I'd had watching a sci-fi film since Star Wars in 77. It's odd to me that I still haven't read any Guardians comic books. I don't know what the reasons are. Maybe it's because there hasn't been a From the Beginning compilation, and I have no idea whatsoever where to start. And the second, which I know this is going to come bite me on the backside, is I often wonder if the comics are as awesome and funny and engaging as the films. Mm. Hopefully, someone out there, and I'm looking at you, George, can help me out with an opinion or advice. Be gentle.
There's a jumping on point on Guardians of the Galaxy, because there was an original Guardians of the Galaxy gang, which is very different from the characters in the film. And
yeah.
This iteration is based on the comic books written by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning. And they rebooted it, basically, put this team together. And they get a credit, certainly in the first movie. And I'd highly recommend you pick up those comics because it's the same tone, it's the same styles, the same
okay,
characters.
Cool.
That would explain why I didn't understand it, because I used to read the Starboard comics when Marvel were printing them over here as anthologies in the 1970s, and of course it's very, very different.
Yes,
in fact,
yeah,
once I read he's on his own.
Yeah, yeah. And I think he's got a solo comic again now as well, but he's still part of the team as well.
Oh, that's good. Right, as the film starts, we see the Guardians are ready for battle. Same lineup as we left with last time, and as usual, they can't agree on anything. Not even their strategy for taking on a monster from another dimension. But their bickering's totally in character, and this makes for as great an opening for the sequel as seeing Peter Quill dancing around the ruins was for the first film. It tells you exactly what you need, without any lengthy exposition or explanation. And there ensues a massive fight while Baby Groot, who's the focal point of the sequence, believe it or not, is dancing around to cheery ELO Mr. Blue Sky, and it's the perfect opening for what's to follow. We've been playing a lot of the awesome mix from Volume 1 on the show, and believe me, Volume 2 doesn't disappoint. It's been playing in my car now for a fortnight. Anyway, what's the film about? Well, where the first film obviously was mainly concerned with the forming of the group of misfits who would become the Guardians of the Galaxy, this one consolidates what went on before and explores the origins of ringleader Peter Quinn. Now, we know that he was abducted from Earth on the night his mother died in hospital of a brain tumour, and the origins of his father remain a mystery. Well, here we explore that mystery and find that his father's an extraterrestrial living planet called Ego.
Wow.
Who gave himself human form.
As you do.
As you do, and is played by Kurt Russell.
Oh, fantastic.
Brilliant. It is fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
It's perfect. But that's only half of it. Because there's also the matter that, unsurprisingly, Rocket has managed to get them into trouble by stealing from a very vindictive bunch of people what they were actually hired to guard. So they are now on the run. Not only that, but who remembers the Ravager leader, Yondu, the guy who kidnapped Peter Quill, the blue guy?
The blue guy, yeah.
Yeah. He has his own set of problems because the Ravagers, the pirates that he was a member of, are booting him out in dishonor for having basically kidnapped the child in the first place, because they were hired to pick up Peter Quill and take him to his father, Ego. But he used that Yondu used Peter Quill for his own ends as a thief. And the leader of the Ravagers is just booting him out in disgrace. And are you ready for a surprise?
Don't give
away too many
spoilers.
The leader of the Ravagers is played by Sylvester Stallone.
Oh, no.
It just doesn't get any better.
So what's this awesome film called, Robin?
It's called Guardians of the Galaxy Part 2.
Good.
Now, the performances are truly great. All of them. All of them. But the film really belongs to Dave Bautista, who, oddly enough, is an ex-WWE wrestler. And other than Dwayne Johnson, is the only wrestler, in my opinion, to have made a really good impact on the cinema. As for the CGI characters, Groot and Rocket will make you forget you're watching a special effect because you're going to completely buy into their characters. There's a cameo from David Hasselhoff.
Oh, well, that's it. It's a proper film, then, isn't it? Is it?
There's
a
line
film without Hasselhoff,
you laugh even now. And basically, it's Yondu, the big blue guy, saying, "Hey, I'm Mary Poppins, y'all." You have to see it in context. You are going to fall off your seat laughing. There are no drawbacks to the film. I found it to be a sheer, fast-moving, epic delight from the opening frame to the last. It doesn't sag, it's not bloated, and it never lets up.
And I believe that Patricia saw the film as well
this week.
So.
It's brilliant.
It is.
If the original is 10 out of 10, then the sequel is definitely 9 out of 10.
Wow.
Absolutely. I would call it a 10, actually.
Uh-huh.
My feeling at the moment, and I hope I'm wrong, is that the summer blockbuster season has already peaked.
It might, but, you know, the Wonder Woman movie might be just
and
really
Spider-Man
awesome.
Well.
It's the first time I've ever looked forward to anything to do with Wonder Woman, because it looks amazing. And that little riff of guitar music they have for her, it just sends shivers down my spine.
Mm.
I've not seen it either. Makes me sound like Wild Stallions. Does she do the thing with her...
Oh, she's amazing.
I'm just hoping we don't have an invisible plane, because I could never get over that.
So, Robin, stay with us.
I will.
Bit of ELO there, Mr. Blue Sky. And now we're going to come back to Mr. Andrew Beach. And I'm sure we're all Doctor Who fans here. And we've been to the Doctor Who experience. Anybody in the room been to the Doctor Who experience?
Yeah,
yes,
we
do.
Have you been there, Andrew?
Just a few times. Well, every episode, obviously, of Doctor Who presents a multitude of amazing and costumes and props and monsters. And someone has to decide what to keep and then how to preserve them for the future. And key among that group is Andrew Beach. And I'll tell you a little bit more about Andrew as well. He was also one of the founding members, shall we say, of the Dwarf Society. So if anybody's a real Doctor Who fan, they'll know who they are. And he's an independent advisor for Bonhams Auctioneers. Knows an awful lot about memorabilia and props, and I hope I'm saying that right, Andrew. And he also has another role. He's a content supervisor and therefore curator of our Doctor Who experience. And so tell us, Andrew, how do you make a decision about what should go in the Doctor Who experience?
Well, just very quickly before I say anything else, I have to make clear that I'm here in a personal capacity as a friend of Sam and David and a Doctor Who fan, and I can tell you a few things. But if I'd been given an official remit to come here and talk to the BBC, it would have taken about 3 weeks to go through all the fair trading and editorial policy considerations. So I shall tell you what I can. In terms of preservation of props and costumes, you'll appreciate that, first of all, they're not really made for that purpose. They are made purely for the purposes of making a television programme. Therefore, mm-hmm. from certain people's point of view, as soon as they have had their few seconds or several minutes or however long it is on the screen, they have ended their useful life, and that's an end to the matter. However, given the way in which audience enthusiasm for the show has burgeoned over the years, people are very, very interested in actually being able to see these things in person, live and up close.
Absolutely.
So, in actual fact, we tend to try to preserve as many things as we possibly can until we get feedback in to find out what has found favour with the audience mm-hmm. and what hasn't.
So how does that work then, Andrew? So they make a Doctor episode down at Cardiff. The experience is at Cardiff at the moment, at least, which is fantastic. So an episode airs, there's then a pile of costumes and props and bits and bobs and stuff the Doctor picked up and waved around or whatever. So they keep all of it? Or does somebody then go in and say,
Well, they won't keep absolutely every single thing. I mean, obviously, you get advanced sight of the scripts, and very often as you're going through those, as and when something is described or mentioned, be it a costume, a piece of set or a hand prop, obviously one will make an initial assessment as to whether or not that's likely to be something that's going to be interesting.
Okay.
Clearly, if you have something made where it's going to be destroyed or damaged or blown up in a sequence in its entirety, then there wouldn't be any point in keeping that. We'd probably keep the hero original of it, but not the damaged bits and pieces.
So someone goes in, and as they clear the studio of recording Doctor Who for that particular episode, all the bits and bobs that were identified are kind of put into storage somewhere, and then does everything end up on display? How does that get?
Well, it's not absolutely everything that ends on display, and indeed, it isn't even as simple as that. Basically, everything that's been used, which hasn't been destroyed or damaged in such a way that it isn't capable of being salvaged, would be taken aside, and then our people would go in and take the things that we are going to display. And the intention, obviously, is because we want to keep refreshing the exhibition to keep people coming back.
Yes.
Over and over again, we will, review and change the displays from time to time.
Absolutely. Because, we've been to the exhibition, I think, a couple of times now, haven't we? I think, is it once we've been?
I think we've actually been once.
Only once,
yeah. We'd like to go again.
Yeah. Mm. So when Doctor Who's on, as it is at the moment, so, for example, when they'd transmitted the first episode of the pilot, how soon after that would things from the pilot then be in the experience?
It varies from time to time. You'll appreciate there's a complete embargo on anything being put on public display
in advance, of course,
before
yes.
the episode has been shown. But, I mean, the actual redress of the exhibition part of the experience to take into account season 10, which is currently transmitting, is actually going to be in a couple of months' time because there'll be a big launch for that. Mm. But, for example, the quickest it's ever been was after the most recent Christmas episode.
Yes.
We had one or two of the set elements and the ghost costume actually on display the day after transmission.
Wow. So sometimes it can be really quick, but other times it depends on other considerations and all sorts of things.
That's very cool.
That's amazing. So does the BBC try and retain everything? Do you try and keep as much as can be kept? Because there's obviously a storage consideration, I would have thought.
Absolutely, yes, and largely that is the case, because you have to try and work out exactly what is going to be capable of long-term preservation, and even the things that aren't obviously have a value, and, one has to look at ways of generating revenue to keep the show going above and beyond the BBC licence fee, and therefore, since these things do get auctioned from time to time, obviously you want to hold on to them because that might be their ultimate destination.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, when we went to see it, I remember there was like the Davros enclosure from which is familiar, those two episodes.
Yes.
There was also the teleport device from Heaven Sent that was there. So there's not
and some consoles.
But I was just going to go and say there's not just like prop elements like the Sonic Screwdriver or stuff like that. There's actually sort of set elements as well. Mm. So it must be kind of quite complicated, and someone has got the job of saying that would look really good in a display. Can we keep that whole set? Can we keep the set elements? Can we keep this? Can we keep that? Can we keep those tubes? Quite complicated, I would have thought, to try and figure out what you're actually keeping.
Not really.
No?
As I say, most of the things get kept. We've already indicated earlier on which ones we think are going to be particularly interesting, and then as and when it's all been preserved, somebody will go along and work out exactly how we want to display these things in what context.
It's fascinating.
And then select the elements.
So what if the BBC doesn't want to keep something? I mean, that sounds like that doesn't happen very often.
No.
I mean, what happens if they don't want to keep something? Does it just literally get thrown away? Like you said, if something's been blown up,
The only reason why anything would ever be thrown away would be if it had been damaged to such an extent that it was no longer recognised for what it was. Basically, it's either all kept in storage, which we try to do with most of it, or there are selected periodic auctions.
Wow, that's amazing, isn't it? So what do you think is the most important item that perhaps is on display or in the experience that people would want to see and go and see?
It's very difficult to say because, apart from anything else, it's such a personal
true.
Yeah, I would have thought
issue. And in fact, that's quite an interesting part of the job, is that you have to bear in mind that you're not actually doing things for yourself. You're actually trying to make sure you're servicing the majority of the audience, and the audience has a tremendously eclectic range. I think an awful lot of people, certainly as when the experience was being devised some 6 years ago now, the one thing everybody came back on their forms that we sent out to get feedback as to what people would like to see in a 21st century exhibition was to be able to go into and fly the TARDIS. So that's obviously why we have the interactive adventure the way we do. But following on from that, I think in actual fact a lot of the people like to see the other TARDIS sets and police boxes and the Doctor's individual
stuff.
So it's
the iconic elements.
I think it's the TARDIS related stuff, the gadgets, particularly the sonic screwdrivers. And a lot of obviously the Doctor's and Companions costumes, but also the Time Lords.
Oh, I love seeing the costumes.
Do you have a personal favourite item, Andrew?
I do.
Preserved. Will you tell us what it is?
No.
You can't tell us what it is.
I am Bruce.
You're taking the fifth on that one.
Take the Fifth Amendment.
I'm only a humble curator. I'm sure I wouldn't know.
Do you ever find that the BBC are making a new series and they come back to you to look to say, actually, we want to put this element in from the past and come
into
and have
the
it
show.
Back?
Yes, we have done that.
In actual fact, we've had sometimes go to certain strange lengths of subterfuge to take things off display and in some way hide the fact they've actually disappeared for a little while because they're being used for something, because obviously we don't want people to work out they're actually going to be coming up in the programme in the future. That has happened quite a lot.
I remember there was a circumstance where all the Jadoon costumes suddenly disappeared, and that was because I think Stephen was using them in the episode or with the Daleks, and they were the guards, I think, in that episode.
I'm not familiar with that story. It may well be the case. I don't know.
I seem to remember someone saying, oh no, the Jadoons have all gone off display. I wonder why. Dear. That's amazing.
Well, fantastic.
On Siren FM 107.3.
Are you there? Are you there? Are you there?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is who we are.
Coffee House Hermits from Lincoln, England. We're all travellers in space and time.
With strange characters.
And it's the one with the nose.
I absolutely love her.
And surprises galore.
A free concert. Think of it as being sung to by Elvis Presley.
Unusual discussion topics.
Why would you want to give every child a water pistol? It was a bit like choosing between kittens and babies.
That will make your ribs soul.
You have really done your homework.
That's what we call show business.
Join the Midweek Drive team every Wednesday from 5 till 7 on Siren FM 107.3.
Hi, this is Chase Masterson, and you're listening to Sam Stone and Friends with the Stone Tapes on Siren FM.
And just a reminder of who's in the studio, we've got Patricia H. Ash,
yeah.
George Mann, David Howe, and our special guest Andrew Beach.
We are Brute.
And, of course, on our telephonic link, Robin Pearce.
I am Groot.
Now we're off to the Man Factor. George, what would you like to talk to us about today?
Well, I thought it would be, since we've got a comic-themed episode today, I thought, surprisingly, I might talk about comics again.
Why not?
And a subject that I've been looking into from a writing perspective, but actually more from a reader's perspective, is the big summer, well, not big summer, big event series that that the comics publishers do, where they, yeah. You know, I'm sure everyone here knows the comic universes of Marvel and DC and Valiant and all of those things are all meant to be kind of contemporaneous amongst themselves. So Batman exists in the same world as Superman and Wonder Woman, etc. And what you tend to get every now and then are these big events that happen that are meant to shake the foundations of the Marvel universe and have implications across, you know, all of the books and all of the characters.
Civil War?
Yeah, like exactly like Civil War. That's a perfect example. Flashpoint in the DC universe, that kind of thing. So I've been looking at events recently and reading events, and I don't know if you recall, about a year ago when I came on and talked about DC Rebirth,
yes.
And how they'd rebooted, yes. Their entire range, all number ones, and they changed the continuity to bring back all the old fan favourite stuff. And I kind of see that as a bit of an event. And I think this is an example of where a publisher's done a really good job of having this big kind of story arc through their universe, but not alienating people or making you feel that you're missing stuff. Which is one of my big gripes that I've been battling with,
sure.
Recently. So DC, for example, they had when they launched Rebirth, they had a one-shot comic that was kind of a graphic novel length, and it introduced all these big concepts and this big mystery about someone's been playing with time, and explaining all the continuity changes that they'd had in the past and kind of rebooting it. And then every comic went off and did its own thing, and DC have done a really good job of packaging different characters for different segments of the market. So there are things that are clearly not aimed at me. The demographic might be teen girls. And they've got characters that kind of work for that, and that they've got that tone and style, where there are things that clearly are aimed at me as an older comic fan. And I've been able to kind of read those stories without worrying about the fact I'm missing stuff elsewhere. But recently they've just brought a little crossover event together with two issues of Batman and two issues of Flash, where they've moved the story on, the arc. It was four issues, quite self-contained, and you've seen the arc move on, which is all really jolly. And in a few months' time, they've announced there's going to be another kind of mini-series, self-contained mini-series, that does a bit more of that. On the flip side, I've been really struggling with some of the Marvel events recently, where they have a core four-issue, six-issue miniseries. Civil War 2 is a good example. But then every comic across the whole range that they publish for a period of months is a Civil War tie-in. And you really start to feel like you're missing stuff if you're not reading them all.
Yeah. Ooh,
and I understand, yeah. From a commercial point of view why a publisher would want you to go and try other comics that you're not reading, but it gets a bit onerous.
Yeah.
It's a bit like I'm a Doctor Who fan and the BBC are having a big Cybermen event, and I watched the first episode and it ends on a cliffhanger, and now I have to tune into EastEnders to find out what happens next.
You know, that's
it's
strange,
kind of
isn't it?
Moving around
Did I miss that one? Which was actually, Doc Cotton was revealed as the
actually, what, that would actually be worth a watch, wouldn't it?
Now, Robin, you're quite a comic fan, aren't you? So
yeah.
What's your thoughts on what George has just said?
Well, I agree a lot with George. I live out in the middle of nowhere where we have no comic book stores, and so it's virtually impossible for me to get any continuity, like, for example, Civil War or Crisis on Infinite Earths,
yeah.
I have to wait until the graphic novel comes out.
Hmm.
So reading them episodically on a monthly basis is completely out of the question for me, because the distribution market has changed, and it's direct sales from comic book stores rather than your local newsagents that would where you could buy them years ago.
Patricia, any thoughts?
Not really. I mean, I know that Marvel is experimenting with sort of internet comics.
Distribution, like a PDF. Yeah.
They've got a subscription thing where you can read, like, most, if not all, of the comics.
Right.
And I'm wondering if maybe that's why
yeah.
they're spreading their things out over so many different series.
It's kind of a Netflix for comics for Marvel, Marvel Unlimited. Actually, it's really good, and that's the way I would go back and read if people are interested in reading the whole of an event. Because, like Robin was saying, you know, I have got a comic shop near me. I subscribe to comics. I buy digital comics as well. I just can't keep up with the reading. If you have to read, you know, 30 comics to understand what's happening in an event.
It's hard, isn't it? I mean, is the digital reader the one, because I remember hearing about a digital reader for comics, where it follows, it's programmed to follow the structure of reading the comics. So you don't just, like, see the whole page on the page, as if on your tablet. It, like, shows you a frame at a time and then swoops to the next, and then
it's
programmed to follow. So it's not
comicology.
Quite the same as just reading a comic, where your eyes do it.
That's comicology, isn't it?
Yeah. Is that one, yeah?
It's comicology, and it's very clever. So if you've got an iPad and you just want to have the whole screen
as a page,
you can. But if you're reading it on your phone, actually, or something, or you're on the bus
you can do
a panel at a time.
Ah,
it's kind of a swipe for the next panel, and it just moves around.
It knows the structure of reading
the frames of
the comic.
How does that deal with comic pages that sort of break the panels?
It zooms you out again.
Double pages.
Which can be problematic if you are on a smaller screen.
Yeah.
But it's a very clever process.
I think we're going to have to spend more time on this, because I think...
Yeah, something that we need to explore a bit more.
This is a big subject, and we need to talk a bit more about this.
Andrew, do you ever read comic books?
Yes, I do. I certainly was familiar with the DC Quest on Infinite Earths. I've only really stopped in recent years because I've got so many other things to do. I can't keep on top of everything.
Yeah.
I had to stop on a slightly different point. I had to stop watching all the different variants of Star Trek in the 1990s because there were just too many of them to keep up with it all and carry on with everything else I had to do. But no, I still enjoy them. And I used to read them way, way back in the 1960s.
Oh, very cool.
Wow, okay.
Alex is just showing me on his tablet
how
this works. This is so clever. And you do. You just click, and it's done. And
it's
a Doctor Who one, actually.
Supremacy of the Cybermen.
Yeah, I'll just describe
it.
I believe that's
a great comic.
It's a great comic. Supremacy of the Cybermen. There you go. This is brilliant.
And I will have a little bit of Norman Greenbaum, Spirit in the Sky.
And it's time for David's Film of the Month.
David's Film of the Month, and you won't be at all surprised to learn that this month we have been watching Guardians of the Galaxy!
Not number two, but number one.
Not number two, but number one. So, it's apparently being retroactively referred to as Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1, which is kind of, that's good, but it wasn't called that on the video, that DVD that we saw.
No.
Made in 2014, based on Marvel Comics, produced by Marvel, and it's, it says here, it's the 10th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I just, it's just amazing, isn't it? So we've gone like Hulk and Iron Man
only
and Avengers, and this is only the 10th. You'd think there were millions. Directed by James Gunn, who also wrote the screenplay with Nicole Perlman. And it's got a fantastic cast. Chris Pratt, Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista, Vin Diesel. He is Groot. He is Groot. Bradley Cooper, Lee Pace, Michael Rooker, Karen Gillan off of Doctor Who. Except she's kind of blue and had her head shaved and mechanical implants put in her. She's a bit borgish.
Jimon
Hounsou, John C. Reilly, Glenn Close, and Benicio Del Toro, the Wolfman himself. They're all in it. And it's a tremendous film. We watched it again last night, and there is so much packed into this film. It is unbelievable. It kicks off from the word go. It's awesome, fantastic. These characters kind of come into it. They end up in a jail and they meet some other characters and they have fights and it's just this, that, the other. Oh, it's just incredible.
They become reluctant allies.
They
really,
become
don't
reluctant
they?
allies. And he is Groot, kind of helps them out. And there's a little raccoon guy called Rocket, which is fantastic. And it is just the most amazing, amazing film to watch because I think it just sucks you in. And I think you start off going, what am I watching? And it just rolls on through and everyone is so likable.
Yeah.
It's
well developed.
Such a great film. Yeah.
There's not a character who doesn't have a backstory. Like even that guy from the Nova Corps with the cute family.
Yeah,
he's got a really interesting backstory.
I thought
it
was a singing group at first, the Nova Corps. I thought there was like, you know...
the Nova people...
John C. Reilly.
Yeah.
It could have been.
Mr. Silverbank.
They were tremendous. And Mr. Batista, who isn't the guy off of Dexter, he's the guy with all the tattoos all over him. Drax, absolutely fantastic.
Oh, he's great, yeah.
I mean, Zoe Saldana plays Green Girl, you know, Star Trek, Eat Your Heart Out. She's like the ultimate Green Girl. She's fantastic. No, absolutely... thoroughly enjoyable film.
Yes.
Thoroughly enjoyable.
What were your thoughts, Andrew, having only seen it for the first time last night? Or was it the first time you'd seen it?
There aren't any Daleks in it.
Film can be improved by adding Daleks.
I have seen it before several years ago, but it was actually at a party where various things were going on. It was in the background, so I hadn't really given it my full attention. But no, I very much enjoyed it. I did, as I mentioned earlier in the programme, and thankfully George has put me straight. I was finding it quite difficult to square the... Chris Pratt character, Star-Lord. With the Star-Lord I'd read about in the original Marvel comics because it was a different iteration, but now that's been explained, so it makes
sense.
It's a perfect... they've judged perfectly the mélange of sort of the action, the adventure, but also the very wry humour, and the music is just brilliant.
It is brilliant.
So, Robin, all concurs with you?
Absolutely. I mean, when you think that it's essentially a superhero film about a bunch of petty criminals.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. It's a perfect film.
It's like Blake 7 done differently.
Oh.
George,
I never liked Blake 7.
Final thoughts on Guardians of the Galaxy?
I absolutely loved it. I think my favourite joke in the whole thing is the Kevin Bacon thing. You know, where he sells her on Kevin Bacon being a hero.
So it's a firm 10 out of 10 for me.
Yeah.
10 out of 10.
Yeah.
10 out of 10, definitely. For
Robin?
Me.
10.
10 for me.
10.
I'd have to give it 9 because I'm a perfectionist.
He still didn't have Daleks in it, so he could only get 9.
He get 9 because no Daleks.
Maybe they'll put Daleks in Volume 3.
Maybe they will. That's all from us. Thanks so much to David J. Howe, Patricia H. Ash, Robin Pierce, George Mann, our guest, Andrew Beach, and of course our producer, Alex Letchup. And I did say Robin Pierce, didn't I?
You
named everybody. And I'm Sam Stone. Say goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
I am Bridge.
Seen your face, draw back in fear.